Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program will visit Blue Hill and the Marine Environmental Research Institute for a talk sponsored by Cornerstones of Science in Brunswick. The speaker is University of Maine professor Dr. Stephen Coughlin. His topic, the Penobscot Undammed, Restoring the River. This program will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Rebecca Carino, Director of Communications at the Marine Environmental Research Institute.
My name is Becky Carino. I am the Director of Communications here at MARI. This evening, we have an interesting group of people joining us, but also a wonderful topic. I wrote something down when I was researching Steve. And as I mentioned, there's a passion for the ocean. There's a passion for the environment. And he wrote something in a personal essay. Unfortunately, you do have it on the web.
It's on the web.
I found it. And the reason, you know, some of us are very fortunate to find what we love to do. And I think Steve found it, if he describes it correctly, sitting by the edge of a pool. And I think you started out in finance. You were going to go into financial whatever. Yes. However, he hasn't left finance. You're still doing a lot of statistics. So he was watching fish in the bottom of the stream. And quote, he said, "I knew immediately that my life would be incomplete without trying to understand and conserve these glorious fish." That is why he is now in the fish, not the industry, but, you know, fish studies. He's on the faculty up at Orono, University of Maine, and he is the assistant professor in freshwater fisheries ecology. But what's really interesting and what really fascinated me is that he also is working on the Penobscot River Restoration, an amazing project that is happening in our own backyard. And the impact of dam removal, I think, is going to be astounding, not only economically for Maine, but also environmentally for the species of fish, just to bring back the thought of having, you know, instead of a few hundred salmon, to have several thousand, 10,000, 12,000 is just astounding. And I really wanted to learn more about what's going to happen. What happens when those dams come down? So to that, I would like Steve to come up and regale us all with a lot of info. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So before I start, I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to be presenting a little bit of my own research, but I'm drawing actually very heavily on a lot of people's work who are much more knowledgeable about the river than I am. Cheryl Daigle's one who's actually here in the audience, and she can probably answer a lot of questions at the end if I can't. Rory Saunders, who's also a big name in the Penobscot research realm, I've taken a lot of his work. Some of my co-authors. So really, a lot of these people here could have given this talk, and I'm really appreciative that you invited me. And one other thing, too, I don't wear a watch, and I don't know how long it's going to be, so when you're getting sick of me talking, Becky or whoever, just start waving, and I'll try to wrap it up. So a little bit of background on the Penobscot. Second largest watershed in New England, just behind the Connecticut River watershed. About 22,000 square kilometers that's drained. If you add up all the linear distances of all the perennial streams, it's about 13,000 kilometers, pretty large. Almost 500 meters elevation change all the way from the headwaters down to sea level. And there's about a 40 kilometer or so stretch of tidal zone. So it's a big river, it's long, and it's basically got a huge gradient in environmental conditions all the way from headwaters down to mouth. So I'll just take you a quick journey in the Penobscot River, and especially if you guys are more interested into oceans and not so much into streams, talk a little bit about how a stream works, because that's really important in understanding what's going to happen to the Penobscot. So you go way up in the headwaters, and it might look like this, really small streams, typically cold, well-oxygenated, steep gradient, rocky substrate, and typically closed in by canopies of trees. Now, if we were here several hundred years ago before really heavy logging, those trees there would be a lot bigger, but that's what we have now. Up here, the stream doesn't get a whole lot of sunlight. It stays cool. Most of the energy that feeds the food web of the stream actually comes from the surrounding watershed, from leaves and twigs and bark falling into the streams, also some terrestrial insects. But the stream here is really dependent on what goes on in the terrestrial landscape, in the forest canopy especially. We move downstream just a little bit, and a lot of these smaller streams join together to form bigger streams. Streams are getting a little bit wider. So the little bit more light is reaching through the canopy on the bottom of the stream. We see a little bit more algae growth. Productivity starts to increase a little bit. Maybe temperature rises. Maybe there's a little bit more cycling of temperature throughout the day and throughout the year. Streams getting a little bit bigger can support more life. And we start moving downstream again, where more of these smaller streams come together. And I believe this is the Mattawamkeag. Is that correct, Cheryl? And so here, this might be something of what like the Penobscot looked like way back when. And here it's a big brawling river, a lot of bedrock, ledges exposed, a lot of gradient, steep drops, big boulders. It's a big, mean, ugly river here. It's fast. Let's keep moving further down. This is sort of in the mid-river, maybe down below Howland area. Stream gets pretty channelized and braided. So you've got these alternating stretches of sort of slack water, and then you've got these islands. This is actually pretty tough to navigate around if you don't have a map and you're kind of running a little motorboat through. It's pretty easy to get lost in these islands. But you can see here the river's getting a lot wider. The gradient's not quite so much. A lot of sunlight's reaching the bottom of the stream. It's a little bit deeper. There's a lot more sediment. Move down just maybe a little upstream in the Bangor area, we start to see an increase in gradient. Stream's pretty wide. Again, big, fast water, a lot of deep pools, a lot of exposed ledges. Move down even further, maybe around the Winterport area. I'm not sure exactly where this is, Cheryl, but somewhere near there. This kind of reminds me of the lower section of the Hudson River here near the Hudson Highlands. So it's wide. It's, for the most part, straight. It's tidally influenced. So even if salt water doesn't come into this area, we still have water backing up because of the tides. And, of course, we go downstream, and we're here in Penobscot Bay. A lot of coves, bay, island, a lot of shoreline area. Here it's brackish to salt water. So we've just taken a trip about 350 miles from the headwaters all the way down to the bay, and the river changes quite a bit. And so as a result, the fish communities change quite a bit. And so I'm talking here today mostly about fish. That's what I know a little bit about. So I'm going to stick with fish. So if we want to think about what we want to restore the river to, we need to think about, well, what was the river like historically? So when I think about, well, what were the fish like? We sort of have to think about how they got here and how they persisted. And so basically, if we go back 18,000 years ago, we were under a couple kilometers of ice. So think of this as the glaciers just wiping the slate clean. No fish could live here. And really, any fish that existed were either in the marine environment or they were further down in rivers on land. And so we just follow the glaciers receding a little bit. About 12,000 years ago, we had Lake Iroquois, which is sort of where the modern Great Lakes are today. And there was a lot of fish diversity back then, sort of where the Mississippi River was. And so Mississippi River fish and also sort of Atlantic Ocean fish pretty much could colonize Maine, depending on where the waters flowed. Here's sort of the big event in history. Lake Madawaska actually was connected to Lake Iroquois, or as Lake Iroquois was draining. And so fish could sort of go down from the Mississippi area, go through what turned into be the St. Lawrence River, and end up in Lake Madawaska. And then about 8,000 years ago, there was a route to the southeast that opened up. And it was only open for a few hundred or maybe 1,000 years before it closed off. And sort of up where sort of the St. John River is, actually the rivers flow down this way. So there was really only a brief window of time for any freshwater fish to make it from where the diversity was, that wasn't glaciated, sort of in the center of the country, into Maine. Of course, you could have ocean fish. If they were tolerant of freshwater, they could come up into the lakes and streams. But if you're a freshwater fish, you can't tolerate the seawater. There was really only one way for you to get there, and there was only a brief opportunity of time back historically. So if we traveled back in time, back sort of pre-settlement days, certainly pre-European settlement days, what will we find here? Well, we probably had a pretty interesting diverse array of what we could just call cold water fishes. And cold water and warm water might not be the best term for them, but these are typically fish that you might see in either very cold water or maybe headwater, isolated small bodies. This work? Okay. So we've got things, the usual culprits like a lake trout here, brook trout. These guys are pretty good colonizers of glacial outflow. They can tolerate pretty harsh, cold conditions. We have things like whitefish, which are also pretty tolerant of cold, burbot or cusk if you're a native Mainer. We've got landlocked salmon. We've got long-nosed suckers, couple small minnows there, which actually the biggest diversity in Maine used to be minnows, so fish that we normally don't think of as sport fish. And maybe if we go down in warmer areas or maybe more slowly flowing areas or lakes and ponds, we have native fishes, not a whole lot of diversity, but we have things like white perch, we have brown bullhead, red-breasted and pumpkin seed sunfish, creek chubs and common shiners, and maybe some white suckers. Not a huge diversity, though. Altogether, maybe about 30 or 32 freshwater fish species in Maine historically. And sort of where we see the real diversity and maybe the interesting diversity is in what we call diadromous fish. So diadromy is basically the process of moving back and forth from freshwater to saltwater for some part of the fish's life. And we've got two forms of diadromy. Catadromy is where fish spawns in saltwater and rears in freshwater. Anadromy is the opposite. Fish spawns in freshwater, rears in saltwater. So we've got American eel, which is the only catadromous fish that we have in Maine. But we've got this whole suite of anadromous fish, so fish that spawn in freshwater but do most of their growing and feeding out in the ocean. So we have things like Atlantic salmon, the big charismatic fish, striped bass, of course, short-nosed sturgeon, Atlantic sturgeon, American shad, alewife, blueback herring, and these three are, we'll just call them the shads or the herrings, rainbow smelt, sea lamprey, and there's also a tomcod that I didn't put up there. And brook trout, interestingly enough, can be anadromous. They can go down to brackish water or salt water for some forays. But we had a really interesting diadromous fish assemblage, and there's really no other place you could go south of here, at least, and find this assemblage. You know, you could certainly find alewife and striped bass further south, but you won't find Atlantic salmon much further south. You certainly won't find brook trout. So a really interesting assemblage of fish. So that's sort of what was here pre-European settlement, post-glaciation. And so just a little bit about the life history. This is one taken from Cheryl's website on the Penobscot River Restoration Project. And so basically, fish here, anadromous fish, will do most of their growth and maturation out in the open ocean. They'll come up into fresh water. They'll spawn, and the eggs will incubate. Juveniles will hatch out, and the juveniles will stay in the fresh water for, depends on the species, for anywhere up to several years. Come back down, go through the estuary, and do this all over again. So really what these fish do, these anadromous fish, they really link the terrestrial, the freshwater, and the marine habitats, and we'll get into that a little bit later. They serve as really important vectors of nutrients and energy, that is bringing marine-derived nutrients and energy from the really productive ocean up into fresh waters that aren't so productive. And really these fish depend, they rely on a diverse array of well-connected habitats, and they have to be able to move them back and forth to these habitats as they see fit. And I had one person ask me who was a forester, and he was sort of concerned about logging roads and culverts blocking access to fish moving. And he asked me, well, when do trout actually need to move through these culverts to get to their habitat? And I said, well, whenever they want to, which is pretty true. Whenever they want to move, they have to move, and these fish need to move among habitats. So I'll just go through a couple example species, maybe the most charismatic ones, go through life history. Atlantic salmon. So Atlantic salmon, you know, we sort of think of these big critters out in the open ocean, used to have a commercial fishery for them, but they come back to freshwater to spawn, including the Penobscot River. So they home by sense of smell once they get near their natal river, and about 98% of them actually return to the same river that they were spawned in. Pretty amazing. So they dig these nests called reds in the gravel, and they bury them in the fall of the year. So we've got these eyed eggs or fertilized embryos that incubate in the gravel. Sometime in the spring, they hatch out, and the alevins or the yolk sac fry still have yolk on them. They emerge out of the gravel. They become pretty territorial. They feed on drifting insects in the stream. Depending on their growth rate, they'll live in the stream for anywhere from 1 to, say, 3 years. Some salmon are actually landlocked, complete their whole life history in freshwater. But the anadromous salmon that we have, they would undergo a transformation called smoltification. So as a smolt, they lose all these what are called par marks. They become very silvery. Basically, the cells in their gills that are that osmoregulate, they sort of switch into a backwards mode. So instead of pumping chloride and sodium ions one way, they switch so they can tolerate salt water. They sort of become restless and jittery. They don't feed much, and they basically want to get out to the open ocean. And there they take advantage of the ocean's productivity, come back anywhere between 1, 2, 3 years later. And in Maine, at least, Atlantic salmon have been seen to spawn, I think, up to 8 times over their lifetime. So not like a Pacific salmon. They don't die after spawning. And they're amazing that they undergo these pretty intense marine migrations. They sort of all come out of the Gulf of Maine or the Connecticut River, New Brunswick area, Nova Scotia. And they come up and they'll feed around Greenland sort of as a mixed population, come back down, and then come back in their natal streams. So they do a lot. So anywhere from way up in the headwaters near Mount Katahdin and all the way to Greenland, it's a pretty big migration for a fish that's not all that big. So alewife, also anadromous, a little bit different. Sometimes alewife get a bad name, especially because of problems they've caused where they're invasive in the Great Lakes. Here in Maine and on the coast, they are native. So alewife are out in the, not necessarily the open ocean, they're a little bit closer to shore than salmon, but they'll do all their feeding out in the ocean or the estuary especially. They'll come up in the springtime of the year, and they'll actually migrate up the river and come into freshwater ponds and lakes. They'll broadcast spawn their eggs over vegetation or even sort of out in the water column. They don't necessarily die after spawning, although some do. The embryos hatch out, and the juveniles are in the lakes for maybe 2 or 3 months. Then they migrate down as larvae, and eventually when they're about, a couple inches long or so, they make their way down to the open ocean and hang out in the estuary for a while to feed and grow. And then the next fish, which actually I have a soft spot in my heart for, is the sea lamprey. And they have a very similar life history to the Atlantic salmon in some cases. Again, sea lamprey get a bad name in a lot of places, especially the upper Great Lakes where they're exotic, introduced, and they do a lot of damage to important recreational fisheries. Here in Maine on the East Coast, they're native. So here what we have is out in the open ocean or in, say, a Great Lake, sea lamprey are parasitic. So they latch on to something like a salmon or maybe a seal or a shark or a whale or some other large fish or other large vertebrate, and they bore a hole in the side of the animal with their rasping tongue, and they suck out the body fluids and the juices and the blood. And typically, a lamprey on a big ocean fish is not a big deal. It usually won't kill the fish. Anyway, they'll stay out in the open ocean for a couple of years. Then they come up into spawning streams in anywhere from May to June and May, and they build these really elaborate nests, almost like a salmon does, and I'm going to show a video of that a little bit later on. They spawn, but they actually die after spawning. So like a Pacific salmon, they go on their spawning migration, they give it one shot, and then they're done. So the larvae called ammocetes hatch out, and they're little tiny things. They drift downstream, and they find these really slow, silty backwater areas, burrow in, and filter feed. They basically just pump water through their gill pouches, and they filter out detritus and algae and whatnot. They'll live in the stream anywhere up to 15 or 17 years. They undergo a metamorphosis where they get long and silvery, they get really big eyes, and they head downstream and eventually go in the open ocean and do this all over again. So these are sort of three typical anadromous species we would find. Very complex life histories. The point is, a lot can go wrong when you're moving many kilometers over many different habitats. Here's what happens in the Penobscot River. Anywhere from early spring all the way to almost winter. And here on this axis, anywhere from the estuary, upstream, into tributary streams or up into lakes. And the whole point is, there's a lot going on in the Penobscot River. So let's just follow, for example, alewife. So alewife will come up here from the estuary. They'll kind of move back and forth. They'll go upriver into the lakes. They'll spawn. The young of the year will stay most of the summer. And as they're growing, they'll sort of come back out to sea. There's a lot going on. There's always something in the river. And a lot of times, there's several species together. And what has happened is actually over evolutionary time, species have sort of co-evolved to take advantage of each other at different times of the year. So a big thing to remember about the Penobscot River is we sort of think about the Penobscot as being a main stem river, especially down here, big and wide. And really, this is, for most fish, a corridor. There are certainly some fish like striped bass and shad and sturgeon that, you know, spawn in the lower reaches. But most of what goes on in the river that's really important happens out here. So the Penobscot main stem is really a corridor. It's a conduit, and a lot of important stuff happens in the surrounding tributaries within the watershed. So when I think of the Penobscot River, I think, oh, that's a salmon river. You know, when I moved to the University of Maine and I bought my house, it was on the Penobscot River, and I thought, that's excellent. I'm living on a historic river. I'm doing research on a historic salmon river. And certainly people think of it as a salmon river because that's what people came here to catch, especially in the time when we had photographs and we could actually, you know, publish pictures and newspaper articles. And certainly there were a lot of salmon in the river, and the Penobscot was known for its salmon. But really, according to a lot of people who have studied this river a lot longer than I have, Penobscot wasn't a salmon river. It was a herring river. It was a shad river. It was an alewife river, and it was a lamprey river, too, that just happened to support salmon. And probably one of the reasons that salmon were in the river was because there were alewife, herring, shad, and lamprey. We'll get to that in just a minute. So going back to native fisheries, a lot of the names that we have in the Penobscot River have some sort of translation, as well as people could translate the language as various fishing places. And there's a lot of archaeological studies that show in middens that there were a lot of bones from various species. You can identify them, shad, salmon, sturgeon. You can find archaeological remnants of fishing gears. The natives relied very, very, very heavily on diadromous fish. And so back when people started studying fisheries back in the 1870 or so, talking about not the sort of the anecdotal evidence, well, we found some bones in Indian middens, but what records were kept back then? Well, before obstruction by the dams, there were some quotes. So, for example, the annual yield of salmon could not have been less than 150,000, and the annual yield of shad was probably on the order of 2 million. Now, that's the fishery yield. That's what people had access to, and of course they didn't really know how many other fish were up there. Alewife, as many were taken as would supply demand, maybe greater than 10 million. That's a lot of fish. That's a ridiculous number of fish that I don't think anybody here could possibly fathom. And here's just a quote I pulled from the Penobscot Restoration website. On the morning of May 26th, blah, 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 a true fish story, 7,000 shad and nearly 100 barrels of alewives were taken in Eddington at one haul. Again, a lot of fish. And just another blurb from the Trust website, just showing you the extent of how far these fish reached upstream. Salmon, shad, and alewives traveled 100 miles upstream to Shad Pond in Millinocket, which is near Mount Katahdin. That's a long way up, high elevation. Island Falls in the Mattawamkeag, and all the way up to Monson on the Piscataquis. Striped bass came up far as Enfield and Holland, and Atlantic sturgeon were taken to the falls in Old Town. That's pretty far upstream for fish, especially the sturgeon and the striped bass. We don't think of going very, very far. And so here's just a diagram of the original, the historic range extent of American shad. And sort of we think of shad, or I do at least, well, they spawn down here and they're sort of lower river fish. No, historically they went all the way up almost in the headwaters. Alewife, they're a small fish. They kind of spawn in lakes. They don't go very far upstream. Well, no, that's not true. They go a long way upstream, farther than shad in some cases, and in a lot of cases as far as salmon. These little fish, about that long, can migrate all the way up there historically if nothing's blocking them. It's absolutely amazing if you think about it. So if we wanted to summarize the historic state of the Penobscot River fisheries, we could say it's dominated by huge, unimaginable numbers of alewife shad, probably sea lamprey, even though we don't have good evidence, that penetrated extremely far inland. This Penobscot supported large numbers of Atlantic salmon, hundreds of thousands that penetrated virtually into the headwaters of most areas. Supported populations of striped bass, Atlantic sturgeon, shortnose, rainbow smelt that spawned in the lower reaches. But otherwise, the diversity of native fish was fairly low, and they probably depended on or interacted very strongly with anadromous fish. But we know for a fact that these fish, especially the anadromous fish, provided just absolutely enormous nutritional and economic resources. If it wasn't for these fish and if it wasn't for the forest, nobody would have settled Maine. Why would you possibly brave the black flies, you know, in the winters if you couldn't get tons of fish and tons of trees out? No, there's no reason whatsoever. Well, what happened? So, I mean, this is a story we don't need to go through. We've seen it all over the place. Sort of the big two were overfishing and pollution. We also have some effects like clear cutting of forests, which increase sedimentation, increase water temperatures, certainly have acid rain problems. But of course, what we're here today talking about, last but not least, dams. So here's the Veazey Dam. Is this actually your picture, Cheryl? I'm not sure. I didn't see a photo credit on this, and this was from Rory Saunders, so maybe he took it. But that's the Veazey Dam. That's the lowermost one. So we sort of think of dams in the Penobscot River as being huge and spanning the whole stretch of the river and, you know, creating some hydropower. But really, this is also what we find in the Penobscot River. We find a ton of these little dams. In this case, this is one on Sajunkadunk Stream, actually pretty close to here. Oh, maybe 7 or 8 feet high. Doesn't even do anything anymore. But dams come in, you know, all range of sizes. Pretty much for a fish, there's really no difference between that dam and the previous dam. You can't jump it, you can't get over it. And so if we look at the distribution of dams in the watershed, we have 113 documented dams. There's probably more that we just don't know about. About 20 are producing hydropower in the red dots. About 93 are non-hydropower producing in the green dots. And so we think about the Penobscot River. Yeah, there's a lot of dams down here, but there's a lot of dams everywhere in the Penobscot. I mean, this entire west branch of the Penobscot is dams holding lakes back. A lot around West Enfield Hollow, and a lot of these small streams down here in the lower Penobscot. There's a ton of dams. So the effects of dams vary depending on where you are. So I pulled this out of a report by Maine Department of Marine Resources specifically for the Penobscot. I think everybody knows what the effects of dams are, but I think it's useful to see. Well, we know they block, impede, delay, injure, or kill fish that are trying to move upstream or downstream. They alter stream habitats through dewatering, channelization, filling in, sedimentation. They alter natural flow regimes and water levels, which also changes temperature, water level, change water quality, sediment transport, dissolved oxygen. I don't know if I agree with this one. They reduce overall productivity. I'm not sure if I'm sold on that, but they certainly change productivity. Modify biological communities by creating environments more suitable for certain species, which is absolutely true. I don't know if we could say there's diminished biodiversity, but there's certainly diminished native fish biodiversity. And, of course, they alter opportunities for recreational angling and commercial fishery. We know what dams do. Their effects are seen all over the world. And here's just a quote. You know, you can read, but I'll read it to you. This is shortly after the first dam was built at Veazey in the 1830s. Veazey Dam was closed in the winter. When the fish came in the spring, they found an impassable barrier across their way. They gathered in multitudes below the dam and strove in vain to surmount it. Many returned down the river, and after the usual time for spawning of shad was passed, they were taken in weirs, in Bucksport, pretty close to here, loaded with ripe spawn that they could no longer contain, a phenomenon which Mr. Homer, who has fished with weirs for 43 years, never observed. These were doubtless shad whose natural spawning grounds lay far up the river and who had, after long contention, given up the attempt to pass the Veazey Dam. Great many shad and alewives lingered about the dam and died there until the air was loaded with the stench. So it's pretty poetic, but that's what happens when you block a fish from going where it needs to go. So there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that you could go pretty much anywhere where there's been a dam built, that there's historical records. You can read quotes like this. So let's look at some data. So this is a graph from Rory Saunders put together by a few of his colleagues. Here we have accessible proportion of the Penobscot watershed. So historically, about 100% was accessible, dropped down to about 70%, then almost 0%, and then some dams were opened up and fish passages restored. Here's commercial catch of Atlantic salmon. Well, that's a pretty strong trend. And then after that, commercial fishing was closed, and you couldn't really make money at it because there were no more salmon. Coincidence? Probably not. Here's just some more recent returns of Atlantic salmon. And here's the Penobscot here. And it kind of bumps up and down anywhere from almost zero fish to up to almost 5,000 and back down. But the whole point is, even at the height of the salmon run within the last 30 years or so of 4,500 fish, compare that to 300,000 back historically. That's absolutely nothing. So even in a really good year for salmon that we've been keeping record of returns, that's nothing in the grand scheme of things. Here's just some alewife landings for the state of Maine, not just the Penobscot, but everywhere, millions of pounds. Again, when we started keeping really good records in the 50s, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 million pounds. And really, the last almost 40 years or so, very little. The best year in the last couple decades was less than the worst year back in the 50s and 60s. And so this is not just in Maine. This has been everywhere. And there's a really good paper that came out a few years ago. And Karen Lindberg was actually a professor of mine back in grad school, and I TA'd for her. And she did a lot of work on declines of North Atlantic fishes, diadromous fishes. She went back in the literature. And so basically, she's got several data tables, but these are all fish here in the Western Atlantic that we have, except for the hickory shad. We don't have them here, but everybody else we have in Maine. And basically, she's got a record going anywhere from 1880 or so, or 1814, all the way to the present. This is the percent increase or decrease. All of these populations, the harvested values, declined anywhere up to 99% from historic levels, and all of these have shown long-term decline. Striped bass is a little bit different. They've sort of been a success story, but pretty much everything is declining. Here's some just data plotted out. Sturgeon, shad, alewife, eel, smelt, bass, salmon. That's the trend. Down. Every one of them. And there's certainly some variability, but overall, down. And one thing that Karn and John Waldman warned about was this idea of a shifting baseline. So, for example, a lot of fishery records are kept federally starting at about 1887. So we can say, okay, here 8 million pounds of, or 8 million kilograms of shad were caught back in the 1880s, and yeah, they've declined, but it's not so bad. You know, we're at a quarter of historic levels. Well, what people have forgotten was that fisheries had been exploited a long time before this. So if you go back to fish that actually have data back in the early 1800s, what we think of as sort of the baseline is not really the baseline. That's the baseline. And maybe the baseline is actually further up and further back. So we've sort of lost the idea of how many fish there actually used to be because we only have records for so long. So what Karn and John said, this is sort of their schematic of how diadromous fisheries have collapsed. Back in the pre-18th century, early colonization, there was huge abundance of these fish. They were very easy to exploit, and we depended on them heavily for food. Well, we started to have competing use for waterways. We started building dams and mills. We started digging canals. We started taking water out. We started harvesting gravel. And so these fish that were already fished really heavily, now we're destroying their habitat. We're cutting them off from their migratory routes. Fish are declining. Now over here in these days, we have increased human population growth, increased urbanization. We lose a lot of habitat. And what they're pretty worried about is this loss of memory about their importance. We don't remember how important they were. Therefore, we're not really interested in them. We're not motivated. And we don't have a whole lot of money because we don't remember how abundant they were. And then, of course, you add on top of this climate change. Fish are already stressed for a variety of reasons. You know, this is the reality of where we are for anadromous fish. So, poster child, Atlantic salmon. Atlantic salmon were listed as endangered in several streams in the Gulf of Maine populations back in 2000. They were relisted in 2009. So basically, all the Atlantic salmon found basically in these watersheds here are an endangered species. Central New England, they've been extirpated. They went extinct a long time ago. Long Island Sound, extinct. So really, Maine has the last, and it's not even a stronghold, sort of the last toehold for Atlantic salmon. And they're the poster child for endangered fish. So really, in Maine, we thought about Atlantic salmon because they're a big charismatic species. People love to fish for them. And it's really been a single species focus for many years. We have ladders built in places that work sometimes for salmon, but for nothing else. We had a whole department that was devoted just to Atlantic salmon. We worked on Atlantic salmon. We fish for Atlantic salmon. We have hatcheries just for Atlantic salmon. So it was a very single species salmon-centric focus for a long time. And Rory Saunders, who I'd mentioned a couple times before, and Cheryl, and many other people, including Clem Fay, who's deceased, but actually Cheryl just told me tonight she's actually moved into his office now, so they're connected in that way. These people have thought a long time about Atlantic salmon restoration in the context of other species. So Rory's title here, Maine's Diadromous Fish Community, Past, Present, and Implications for Atlantic Salmon Recovery. So the idea here is that we're trying to restore Atlantic salmon. We know Atlantic salmon are in bad shape, and sort of we know this is their historic range in the Kennebec and the Penobscot. and where the salmon are shown in blue here, they're still there, but it's because we help them out. We either stock them way up there, or we pass them over dams. Salmon are still in a lot of areas they used to be, but at very low numbers. But what about other fish? What about things like alewife, which we don't really pay too much attention to? Well, they used to go up almost as far as salmon, but they're in a very small part of their historic range. American shad, same sort of thing. And a lot of other fish like smelt and lamprey, we don't have this information on. But so Rory and his colleagues came up with this idea that these other species might be extremely important to Atlantic salmon restoration. They presented four key hypotheses about how Atlantic salmon rely on anadromous fish. And the first one's pretty obvious, food source. So especially, for example, imagine you're an Atlantic salmon that spawned in the fall, you're hanging out over the winter, it's cold, you're not eating much, you're hungry, you start to make your way down to sea in, say, April or May. Well, what's coming up to meet you? Schools and schools of rainbow smelt. Very rich in fat, very rich in energy. If you're a salmon that's overwintering and these smelt are coming up, you're going to chow down on them. And it might be the difference between you making it back another year to spawn or not, depending on if there's smelt there. Predation buffering, this is an interesting hypothesis. So if you're an Atlantic salmon smolt and you're leaving the stream in May to go down to the ocean and you're about this big, you're food for everything. You're running an absolute gauntlet of predators. Well, what do you encounter when you're swimming downstream? What's swimming upstream? 10 million alewives. Silvery, about this big, in a big school, also a big buffet item. So if you're one smolt hanging out in 100,000 alewife, you might make it. You might not get chomped by the seal or by the cormorant or by basically anything else. So one of the hypotheses is just the fact that there's all these other fish there at the same time is protecting Atlantic salmon from predation. Here's an interesting one. We know from the Pacific Northwest that migratory salmon, which die after they spawn, are hugely important. So they leave their carcasses, and these carcasses rot and add a huge pulse of phosphorus and nitrogen to the stream. These streams are otherwise very infertile. And the fact that these salmon are dying and leaving their carcasses, actually they fertilize the stream and they increase the growth rate of their offspring that are living in those streams and basically everything else in the food web. We know that happens for Pacific salmon. Well, did it happen here? Well, it's possible that at one point it happened here. Very interesting modeling study done a few years ago by Keith Nislow, who does a lot of salmon work, not on the Penobscot, but somewhere else. But basically what he did, he had this exercise to see how much phosphorus could be either taken to or brought away from the stream by adult salmon coming in and spawning or smolt out migrating out. And so basically, depending on how many fish were passed, anywhere from almost zero adults all the way up to 120 adults in the stream, and how many carcasses stayed in the stream, current conditions, there was not enough adults coming in to the stream, but there were enough juveniles to eat the phosphorus and take it away. So these streams were actually losing phosphorus because the juveniles were eating it up and moving out to sea. If you could increase adults coming back in, or increase how many actually died and left their carcasses, whoops, you would actually get a net import of phosphorus to the stream, which would be enriching. So salmon, historically, might have been abundant enough to give us a lot of phosphorus in these streams. Certainly not now. What about alewife? They come up and spawn in huge numbers. They excrete. Some die. So there are some studies in Connecticut that show, depending on how many adults escape, that is, come up to the fishery, how much phosphorus actually flows into or out of the lake. So here's sort of what the juveniles take out of the lake when they migrate down. At present fish density, the adults bring in about that much. Maybe in 1960s density, they brought in about that much. Maybe in 1800s density, they brought in this much. But in Connecticut, at least, there's so much phosphorus coming in from the surrounding watersheds because it's so developed, these fish don't even really make a dent. But they do bring in so much phosphorus that if they were in a nutrient-poor system, they would have a huge effect. So alewife were probably hugely important. Here's coming back to a fish, again, that has a recent soft spot in my heart. Sea lamprey. Here's one of my grad students who's holding a sea lamprey carcass. They also spawn and die in the stream. So Keith Nislow, again, conducted a study on sea lamprey nutrient deposition, and he did a modeling study based on some sea lamprey data they had in Massachusetts. So what he found was that of all the phosphorus brought in per year, the sea lamprey run brings in about 10 to 20% of it. for the 1 month that they're super abundant in the stream, they contribute more phosphorus than basically anything else in the stream. So for a very short window of time, they can dump a lot of phosphorus in the stream. That's early summer. That's actually a pretty important time when the juvenile salmon are emerging and they're looking for food to eat. And they're hungry. So sea lamprey could also increase productivity by bringing phosphorus in. One other thing that the Pacific salmon do, they have these mass spawning events where they churn up the gravel. They release fine sediment. They move the rocks around. They make it very permeable. They make it easier for future salmon to come and spawn. And there's been studies that have shown that when a salmon run declines in a stream because of a dam or whatever, the gravel actually gets more compacted over time because there's not enough salmon returning to churn it up. And the salmon that do return have a harder time digging reds, and they don't dig their reds deep enough, and they can't get below the freeze line or the flood line. So there's sort of this positive feedback where if you stop salmon from spawning, the habitat quality just goes down. Well, what could happen in Maine rivers? Well, Atlantic salmon might be able to spawn and churn up the gravel quite a bit. But what about what we have left in the Penobscot? So there's our sea lamprey. That's how they spawn. So they grab onto rocks and they thrash their tails around, and they basically release plumes of fine sediment. They'll grab those rocks and they'll pull them down. You can see this really nice clean spot right there. So these fish actually have the capacity, like a Pacific salmon, to churn up the gravel and make better habitat for Atlantic salmon. It's amazing. I've got hundreds of hours of this at home, and I just sit there and watch it. We actually have a study going on to see, can they actually condition spawning habitat to the benefit of other fish? So here's my grad student who is holding up that delicious dead lamprey. Here's some data from lamprey mounds, the nests, which have a mound structure they pile these rocks on, a pit structure they dig out, and then reference areas around them. So this is just the amount of fine sediment that's actually destructive to Atlantic salmon nests, anything less than 2 millimeters in diameter. The lamprey do a really good job of cleaning out especially the mound area relative to the reference area. So they basically leave a nice, clean, silt-free series of rocks for salmon that could spawn in. And what they actually do is they increase the number of interstitial spaces in between these rocks, which makes it easier for Atlantic salmon to spawn, but also gives the juveniles a spot to hang out and feed and be free from predation. So we're showing some evidence that the lamprey actually do make habitat better for Atlantic salmon, much like Pacific salmon do. So their working hypothesis is recovery of co-evolved diadromous fish will facilitate the recovery of Atlantic salmon. So what I'll say before I go on to sort of the last part of the talk is dam removal is a necessary but probably not sufficient first step to restore diadromous fish and to restore natural functions of the Penobscot River. Notice I put that natural in quotes because we're gonna get back to that in a minute. So, and this is something that Cheryl could tell you a lot more about, but the Penobscot River Restoration Project is just an unprecedented collaboration to remove two main stem dams on the Penobscot River down here, the Veazey Dam and then the Great Works Dam, to install, it will improve fish passage at Milford and also up here at Howland for a new fish bypass, ramping up hydropower production on a couple other dams so there's no net loss. But it's really unprecedented. This is the first dam that fish encounter on their way out from the sea. It's a huge project. It's been in the works for about 10 years now. And maybe next year, I think if all goes well, Great Works Dam is going to be the first to come out. Year after that, VZ is going to be the next dam to come out. So just an absolutely amazing project, and Cheryl's done a ton of work. So this is, if you go on the Penobscot River Restoration Project website, you can see this. So here's sort of what fish have access to now. And then here's what they call significantly improved access for sea-run fish for nearly 1,000 miles. And that's true. It is significantly improved. One thing we'll notice here is that the West Branch of the Penobscot's off the radar. But for really most of the rest of the watershed, there is significantly improved habitat access for these sea-run fish. But one thing that we need to remember is while most of what we're talking about is sort of down here, what's left in the rest of the river, there are a lot of dams left. So even if we take out these two monstrous main stem dams and install fish passage or improve fish passage at others, there's a ton of dams left. So we have to keep that in mind. So this is something that Rory Saunders and his colleague Tara Trinko put together. So these are just small watersheds. Every watershed has a color code that shows how many fish or how many dams a fish has to pass through to get in that watershed. So anything that's yellow means no dams, they can get there on their own free will. The darker the gray or black color, the more dams they have to pass through. So here is pre-Penobscot River Restoration Project. They've got some access down here. Kenduskeg is actually sort of the bright spot. But everything else is pretty gray. So I'm going to click back and forth a couple times so you can see. Look for the color changes. What's going to happen after these two lowermost dams are removed and some fish passage is restored? Keep clicking back and forth. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of people hear about the Penobscot River Project. They think, oh, this whole watershed's going to turn yellow. Well, that's not what's going to happen. We certainly see a little bit of yellow here, which is good. That's about the Great Works area. We see a lot more white, one dam to go through. We see a lot more light gray. But unfortunately, there's still a lot of black. This whole West Branch is black. So it's going to improve things, but it's not a silver bullet. It's not going to open up every single square inch of river. It's going to improve access, but it's not going to completely restore access. So I think it's important for people to remember that. And Cheryl and Rory and all these other people who work on this, it's very important. They tell people this all the time. So it's important the public does know this, or they should. They have the information. So in the management plans or restoration plans for these species, here's sort of the big guys right here, all the diadromous fish, and most of these dams here, at least some of the lower dams and on the bigger tributaries, they're scheduled to have fish passage to pass most of these fish. Things like sturgeon, they don't actually go up past any of these other dams, so they don't spawn. Atlantic salmon can make it up, you know, with some assistance, hopefully all the way up to Medway. American eel all the way up there, blueback herring and alewife, not quite sure about sea lamprey. But people had these fish in mind in removing these dams. But we do still have some other, or we will have some other fish passage issues. We'll have problems with downstream movement of adults. So, for example, spent Atlantic salmon after they've spawned, spent shad after they spawn, if they want to get back down to the ocean, maybe come back again, going over a dam, it presents a different sort of difficulty than coming up over a dam. Downstream passages of salmon smolts, other juveniles like shad and herring, and also eels of all sizes. Eels especially are notorious for getting chopped up through turbines, and we find pieces of eels all the time, especially below Great Works or Milford Dam. There are a lot of non-lethal effects. Fish can certainly become disoriented when they're going over a dam. There can be just effects on them if they're delayed, if they miss the optimal environmental conditions of the run. The Stillwater Branch, there's still a lot of dams there. So if the fish are coming up the Penobscot River, they can either take a right-hand turn and go to the dam-free section, take a left-hand turn and go to the Stillwater. Well, if they don't know which way to go, they're going to encounter a lot of dams. And of course, there's a lot of other small dams in the watershed that still remain. So I want to give you a little background on some of the research that we've been doing. Here's Sajunkadunk Stream, and I call Sajunkadunk Stream a piece of the Penobscot puzzle. It's a very small watershed, a couple hundred square kilometers. It's really, you know, less than 1% of the whole Penobscot. It's located down here. It was the site of a dam removal recently. We had the Mill Dam that blocked access just upstream from the Penobscot, the Meadow Dam that blocked access up into Fields Pond. And that's what the Mill Dam looked like. Basically, we would find alewife and sea lamprey swimming around, bumping their head on this dam trying to get up. That was gone in 2009. That's what it looked like 1 month after removal. So, sea lamprey, we've been monitoring sea lamprey populations. This is just a schematic of where their nests were located. 2008, we found about 30 or 35 nests, not surprisingly, all below the dam. 2011, they colonized everywhere, all the way up to the base of a small waterfall so they couldn't get by. So, within 3 years, they basically colonized all of the former, now accessible habitat to them. Fast, right away. This is just numbers of sea lamprey in Sajunkadunk Stream. The stream's small enough so we can actually catch virtually all the lamprey and get a population estimate. Before the dam was removed, 1 year we had 59 spawners. The next year, the year of the Great Flood, we had zero. Dam removed here, 223, 248. Increase. Coincidence? Probably not. Also, after recolonizing Sajunkadunk Stream, we find Atlantic salmon. Maybe these will both go at once. Let's see. Maybe not. So, after the dam was removed, 3 days after the dam was removed, we found 55 Atlantic salmon upstream of the dam, the former dam. They moved up there within 3 days. 2010, we found some of those same fish, but bigger. 2011 was the first year that we actually found successful spawning of Atlantic salmon about 3 kilometers upstream of the former dam site. So it took salmon about 2 years to recolonize. Alewife, well, we found this, let's see, on the left-hand side is a school of adults that were milling right below that little falls I was telling you about. This was the first year after the dam came out. Here we go. These are juveniles. So these fish made it up through the fishway, spawned in Fields Pond. These were the juveniles. We actually videotaped them coming down through the fishway. So there's direct proof that restoration works. You take the dams out, the fish come back, they spawn, they know exactly what they're doing. So is this what's going to happen in the Penobscot River? I think so. I mean, I don't see any reason why not. Of course, this stuff is going to happen in the smaller streams. It's not going to happen right away in the main stem. Here's something I should talk about, exotic species. So we have things like northern pike, black crappie, smallmouth and largemouth bass, green sunfish, fathead minnow, blunt-nosed minnow, fathead minnow, emerald shiner, spot-tail shiner, goldfish, white catfish. These are all exotic species. They were never here before, and they've been found in the Penobscot River. Obviously, people have put them there. These fish can't swim over mountains. They can't swim over the ocean. People have brought them here. Bass are probably the most problematic one that we have today. They were originally stocked with permission. Well, they actually were stocked by IFNW back in about 1867. They were stocked in about 14 ponds or so that are shown in red. The state ceded authority to the general public to stock bass. And those are present-day locations of lakes that have smallmouth bass. Any stream that drains in or out of any one of those lakes have smallmouth bass. So bass now are basically everywhere in the state except for the upper part of the Aroostook River. That's about the only place where they aren't, maybe way up here north of Rangeley area. So smallmouth bass are an extremely dangerous exotic species to have because they basically eat everything they can fit in their mouths. They've been implicated in the decline of native species everywhere. They've caused shifts in food webs. They've caused extirpations of minnow species, but they're everywhere. So the question is, well, what does the fish community look like now and what's it going to look like after we take the dams out? With anadromous species maybe coming back, but with all these non-native species still here. So we've got a study going, boat electrofishing. We're collecting fish from all over the river, but we're especially concentrated down in this lower to midsection of the river to actually quantify what's there, what fish are there, in what abundance, what sizes, and that's going to help us sort of predict, but also actually see what happens, what changes there are after the dams come out. So over 2 years, we've surveyed about 110 kilometers of river that has actually used electricity over 110 kilometers of river to catch fish. We've collected 35 species in the Penobscot and over 55,000 individuals. 35 species is about what was here native freshwater fish way back when. But you can see a lot of what we find today, at least these five, these are exotic species that in a lot of cases, especially the smallmouth bass here, are super abundant. We've encountered just about all the anadromous species there are, all the diadromous species except for tomcod. But we've found a lot of fish in the river. There's a pretty good diversity in the river. So let's just take a look at species richness. Here's sort of the tidal area all the way up to just below Howland. Here's where the Veazey Dam is. This is just number of species we find. Pretty high below the dam, drops off dramatically because of the dam, and slowly recovers as you go upstream, but never to the levels we have here. These areas are augmented by diadromous fish. Well, what do we see for abundance of fish, just sheer numbers of fish per kilometer? Well, these are summer and fall data, pretty low down here, and then once we start getting sort of above the Milford Dam, they're a little bit higher. This is biomass that is kilograms of fish tissue, well, grams of fish tissue per kilometer. Pretty low down here, peaks right in Orono, declines below that dam, or above the dam, doesn't really increase. Well, what are most of these fish? Smallmouth bass in the red, by far the most abundant of any species, especially in these areas that were impacted by the dams. Tons of smallmouth bass. You can't throw a rock in the lower Penobscot without hitting a smallmouth bass. And really, the only place that we see Atlantic salmon are down here. We start to see a native species, white sucker, kind of increase above that other dam. What about small native fish like minnows, common shiner, golden shiner, fall fish? Whoops. We find very few below the dams. Then up, once we get above the dams, we start seeing more of them. So the native species, the small body things, the minnows, they're doing better above that uppermost dam. Here's smallmouth bass abundance just over a couple years, again, going from lower to upstream. And pretty much it's highly variable. The point is you can go anywhere in the river and you're going to find a lot of bass there at some point. This is just biomass of bass, a lot of big old fat fish in that area there. Again, the point is everywhere in the river there are smallmouth bass. If we use some, these are called multivariate ordination techniques, just a fancy statistical way of sort of grouping sites together by how similar or different they are. Well, we find in the river that there's actually a lot of species that tend to group very closely together. We've got a whole bunch of fish that always seem to occur together, things that are either live in the estuarine environment, they're diadromous, or they're restricted by dams. They don't swim very well. We've got a lot of fish that are always found together because they're warm water species. We've actually got some fish that are always found together because they're cold water species, burbot, sculpin, long-nosed sucker, white sucker. And then we've got bass, which really don't group anywhere. That's because they're found everywhere. If we use the similarity of what we find at our sites in terms of fish, our sites actually group together very nicely. Here are all the sites down in the tidal area. Here's all the sites in the middle of the river. Here's all the sites up in the upper part of the river. And then here's some tributaries. So the fish are really showing us that the river changes dramatically as you go from downstream tidal all the way upstream. So the fish tell us what the river's like. So what we can say about the current state of the fish assemblages, we have anadromous species, but they're uncommon, and they're really only seasonally present, and they're only found, for the most part, downstream of VZ. We've got some native cold water fisheries upstream, but they're very far upstream. We have fairly low diversity that's associated with the dams and the impoundments. Diversity kind of improves as you go upstream. And, of course, smallmouth bass is the most abundant and widespread species in terms of numbers and biomass. So there's a couple of other issues that are still facing the river that I'm not going to talk about too much other than they exist. Water quality is a big thing. Blues are AA class water quality. Light blues are class A. Gold are class B. Class C or red way down. You know, there's one right there. A lot of the Penobscot, even what we think of as sort of pristine headwaters, are not the top water quality. We've got a lot of point source pollution. So there's a lot of other issues that are still facing the Penobscot. I'm just talking about fish here. So my last couple slides, you've been very patient, put up through with a lot of information. I appreciate that. So one thing that Becky and I were talking on the phone about was she said, well, in the spirit of Rachel Carson, you know, can you talk about restoring the Penobscot? So the question, can we restore the Penobscot? Well, it depends. What do we mean by restore? Okay, I'm going to ask a bunch of rhetorical questions up here. Sorry. Okay. Can we coax or force the river to resemble its historic state? Okay, that's a better rhetorical question. Well, it depends. How far back in history are we going to go to find the historical state? And that's a valid question. If we're trying to do something to the river, what's our end goal? Okay, can we coax or force the river to resemble its pre-European settlement state? No, no way. It cannot happen for a variety of reasons. Smallmouth bass is the biggest one. There are never smallmouth bass here to begin with. If you want to bring the river back to the historic state, there were no smallmouth bass, you can't do it. There are probably millions and millions of smallmouth bass in the river. You'll never get rid of them. You will never have a Penobscot River that is virtually identical to its old state. It's not going to happen. Well, can we define the question and the answer a little bit differently? Can we restore the historic functions of the river and its biotic components? Possibly, probably have a pretty good chance because of the work that Cheryl and others have been doing. So let's say, well, what's one of our goals? I think a goal for me personally would be self-sustaining populations of diadromous fish that of necessity can access their habitats. So going from saltwater to freshwater and back again unimpeded. That's a pretty good goal. I think we can have that. Well, what's another function? Well, what does a river do? What do fish do in a river? This is really all they do. What rivers do is they transport nutrients and energy that come from freshwater and the terrestrial zone downstream. What do diadromous fish do? They take marine-derived nutrients and transport them upstream. That's really all a river and its fish populations are. It's just a mechanism for bringing nutrients and energy, shuttling them up and down a river over time. And then we're humans, and we like to think, what do we get out of this? Well, we like to think that some of the fish that are actually in the stream are converting some of these nutrients and energy into biomass that are desirable to us for eating or for whatever. And I think something else is very important, especially in light of climate change and probably a number of impending resource shocks that I happen to think are coming pretty soon, sooner than later. Does this system, will it have sufficient resilience to maintain these functions in the face of perturbations that are going to come in the future? And they're probably going to come fast, and they're probably going to come pretty hard. Can we do a good enough job on the river so that if we can bring back some of these fish, bring back the historic functions, can they sustain themselves in light of whatever is going to happen down the road? So maybe this is the better way if we're thinking of, can we restore the Penobscot River? So with that, I know that was a lot of stuff, and I appreciate you guys being a wonderful audience.
You've been listening to University of Maine professor Dr. Stephen Coughlin on Speaking in Maine. He spoke recently in Blue Hill at the Marine Environmental Research Institute for an event co-sponsored by MERI and Cornerstones of Science in Brunswick. If you missed part of the discussion or wish to share the program with a friend, it will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream the programs online or download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.